Chapter 13. Sea Sprite strained against the mooring cables, driving forward with her engines spinning wildly beyond limits never imagined by her designers. No one on the stern deck was looking at the murderous coastline or the endangered hotel. All eyes were locked on the capstan and the big mooring cables that creaked and groaned under extreme stress. If they snapped, the show was over. There would be no saving the ocean wanderer and all those within her glass walls. But inconceivably in everyone's minds, the big cables remained in one piece, just as Pitt had calculated. Very slowly, almost imperceptibly, Sprite worked up to a speed of 2 knots, her bows bucking the great clouds of spray that swept the length of the ship. Only after the hotel had been towed nearly 2 miles off the cliffs did Barnum ease back on the throttles to relieve the overburdened engines. The danger diminished with each yard gained until the menacing rocks and the wild sea had been solidly cheated out of a major catastrophe. The crew of Sea Sprite waved back at the joyous passengers of Ocean Wanderer, who were wildly waving and cheering behind the glass walls. With all fears of death lifted, pandemonium broke loose. Morton ordered the wine cellars opened, and champagne was soon flowing in rivers throughout the hotel. To the passengers and his employees, he was the man of the hour. Hotel guests constantly surrounded and thanked him for his efforts in saving them from a horrible death, fully deserved or not. Stealing away from the joyous bedlam, he returned to his office and sat at his desk in happy exhaustion. As waves of relief swept over him, his mind turned to his future. Though he hated to leave his position as manager of the Ocean Wanderer, he knew that any relationship with Spectre was a thing of the past. He could never work again for the mysterious character who abandoned so many people who were fundamentally his responsibility. Morton thought long and hard. There wasn't an international luxury hotel chain in the world that wouldn't hire him once his part in the drama became known. But becoming known and respected for his achievement was a problem. It didn't take a Nostradamus to predict that once Spectre realized the hotel had survived, he would order his publicity and public relations people to grind out press releases, set up news conferences, and arrange television interviews for the story of how he, Spectre, had masterminded the rescue and was the savior of the famed hotel and everyone in it. Morton decided to grasp his time advantage and leap first. With the hotel phones back in service without interference from the hurricane, he called an old college roommate who owned a public relations company in Washington, D.C., and gave him his rendition of the fabulous saga, graciously giving credit to Numa and the men who engineered the tow. Nor did he fail to mention the brave acts of Emlyn Brown and his maintenance crew. Morton's description of his direction of events during the excitement, however, was not exactly modest. 45 minutes later, he set the receiver back in its cradle, placed his hands behind his head, and smiled like the famed Cheshire Cat. Spectre would counterpunch, to be sure. But once the lead story swept the media and the rescued passengers were interviewed, any follow-up would be diluted. He downed another glass of champagne and promptly fell asleep. "God, that was close," said Barnum quietly. "Nice work, Paul," said Pitt, slapping him on the back. "I'm reading 2 knots," shouted Maverick from the pilot house bridge wing to the gathering, cheering crowd below. The rain had let up, and the sea, whose surface was carpeted by a heavy chop embellished with a pattern of whitecaps, now laid down with waves of less than 10 feet. Hurricane Lizzie, seemingly bored of endangering and sinking ships at sea, was now taking out her rage on the town and cities of the Dominican Republic and its neighboring nation of Haiti. Trees were leveled in the Dominican Republic, but the vast majority of the people survived the gale winds in the interior that was still forested. The death toll was less than 300. But the poorer Haitians, burdened with the worst poverty of any nation in the Western Hemisphere, had denuded their countryside of forested growth to make shacks and burn as firewood. Their buildings, run down from neglect, offered them little protection, and nearly 3,000 died before Hurricane Lizzie crossed the island and swept into open water again. "Shame on you, Captain," Pitt said, laughing. Barnum looked at him quizzically, so mentally and physically exhausted he could barely mutter, "What's that you say?" "You're the only one of your crew not wearing a life jacket." He looked down at his unhindered oil slickers and smiled. "I guess I got too carried away by the excitement to think of putting one on." He turned and faced forward and spoke through his headset. "Mr. Maverick."
"Sir?"
"The ship is yours. You have control."
"Aye, Captain. The bridge has command."
Barnum turned to Pitt and Giordino.
"Well, gentlemen, you saved a lot of lives today. That was a brave thing you did, pulling those cable lines over to Sprite."
Both Pitt and Giordino looked genuinely embarrassed. Then Pitt grinned and said dryly, "It was nothing, really. Just another one of our many accomplishments." Barnum wasn't fooled by the sarcastic wit. He knew both men well enough to know that they would go to their graves in silence before they ever boasted of what they did this day. "You can make light of the magnitude of your actions if you wish, but I, for one, think you did a damn fine job. Now enough talk. Let's go up to the pilot house and get out of the wet. I could use a cup of coffee."
"Got anything stronger?" asked Giordino.
"I think I can accommodate you. I picked up a bottle of rum for my brother-in-law when we were last in port."
Pitt looked at him. "When did you get married?"
Barnum didn't answer, merely smiled and began walking toward the ladder to the bridge. Before he took a well-deserved rest, Pitt stepped into the communications room and asked Jar to call Young, Dirk, and Summer. After repeated attempts, Jar looked up and shook his head.
"Sorry, Mr. Pitt, they don't respond."
"I don't like the sound of that," Pitt said pensively. "Could be any number of minor problems," Jar said optimistically. "The storm probably damaged their antennas."
"Let's hope that's all it is."
Pitt walked down a passageway to Barnum's cabin. He and Giordino were sitting at a table enjoying a glass of Gosling's rum.
"I can't raise Pisces," said Pitt.
Barnum and Giordino exchanged concerned glances. Suddenly, the happy mood faded. Then Giordino reassured Pitt.
"The habitat is built like a tank. Joe Zavala and I designed her. We built in every possible safety device. No way her hull could be punctured. Not at 50 feet below the storm surface. Not when we built her to reach a depth of 500.
"You're forgetting the 100-foot waves," said Pitt. "Pisces may have sat high and dry during the passing of a trough, but then she could have been smashed off her mounts by a solid wall of water into exposed rock amid the coral. An impact that strong could easily have shattered her viewport."
"Possible," Giordino admitted, "but not likely. I specified a reinforced plastic for the viewport that could repel a mortar shell."
Barnum's phone buzzed and he took the call from Jar. He rang off and sat down. "We just heard from the captain of one of the Ocean Wanderer's tugs. They left port and should arrive on station in another hour and a half." Pitt stepped to the chart table and picked up a pair of dividers. He measured the distance between their current position and the X marked on the chart that depicted Pisces. "An hour and a half for the tugs," he said thoughtfully. "Another half hour to release the mooring cables and be on our way. Then 2 hours, maybe less at full speed, to the habitat. Slightly more than 4 hours to reach the site. I pray to God the kids are all right."
"You sound like a distressed father whose daughter is out after midnight," said Giordino, trying to ease Pitt's fears.
"I must agree," added Barnum. "The coral reef would have protected them from the worst of the storm." Pitt wasn't fully convinced. He began to pace the deck of the pilot house.
"You may both be right," he said quietly. "But the next few hours are going to be the longest of my life."
Summer reclined on the mattress from her bunk that she had laid on the angled wall of the habitat. Her breath was shallow as she inhaled and exhaled slowly. She made no attempt at exertion in an effort to conserve as much air as possible. She could not help staring out the viewport at the brightly colored fish that returned after the turbulence and darted around the habitat, gazing curiously at the creatures inside. She could not help but wonder if this was to be her final vision before death took her by asphyxiation.
Dirk was trying every imaginable scenario for escape. Nothing panned out. Using the remaining air tank to reach the surface was not a practical idea. Even if he could somehow break the main portal, which was doubtful, even with a sledgehammer, the water pressure at 120 feet was 60 pounds per square inch. It would explode into the interior of the habitat with the force of a cannon blast and assault their bodies with deadly results. "How much air do we have left?" asked Summer softly. Dirk looked at the array of gauges. 2 hours. Maybe a few minutes more. What happened to Sea Sprite? Why hasn't Paul come looking for us? The ship is probably out there right now, said Dirk, without conviction. They're searching, but just haven't found us in the crevasse yet. Do you think they were lost in the hurricane? Not the Sprite, said Dirk in a comforting tone. No hurricane ever born could send her to the bottom. They went silent as Dirk turned his attention to repairing the smashed underwater radio transmitter in a futile attempt to get it operational again. There was nothing frenzied about the manner in which he began reassembling the damaged connections. He moved with a steady purpose, coldly concentrating on his work. There was no further talk as they conserved their remaining air, relying on the strength they drew from each other. It seemed a lifetime passed as the next 2 hours dragged on endlessly. Above, they could see the sun had returned to sparkle the sea that brushed restlessly over Navidad Bank. Despite Dirk's obstinacy, he simply could not repair their communications equipment. Finally, he was forced to give up in defeat. He felt his breathing become more labored. For the 100th time, he scanned the gauges registering the remaining air in the undamaged tanks. All needles stood fixed on zero. Dirk moved over and gently shook Summer, who had drifted off into a light sleep brought on by the diminishing oxygen left inside Pisces. "Wake up, sis." Her gray eyes fluttered open and she stared up at him with a calm serenity that raised a quick flare of fraternal love within him that was classic among twins. "Wake up, sleepyhead. We have to start breathing from the dive tank." He placed the tank between them and passed the mouthpiece of the regulator to her. "Ladies first." Summer was achingly aware that she and Dirk were facing a situation they could not influence. Helplessness was alien to her. She had always maintained a measure of control throughout her life. This time she was totally powerless, and it was pushing her into despondency. Dirk, on the other hand, was more frustrated than helpless. He felt as though the fates were undermining his every effort to escape their prison and eventual execution. He kept thinking there had to be a way out before they took their final breath, but he met a dead end with every plan he conceived. The end, he came to realize, was rapidly crystallizing into dead certainty.